of the NHS Trust and Ambulance Services in England also in a strike action after voting to reject the latest. NHS England also enters industrial action so far, warning patients delays to services over the strike period. Heather warned that the staffing levels for some areas would be exceptionally on one previous strike days, and the number of events as a result of a strike action was due to hit coming days. Meanwhile, United, the Yorkshire Ambulance Service and NHS Trust in central London also out and staged a protest march in central London. At South Coast and West Midlands Ambulance Trust, the Christie NHS Foundation Trust and Pathology Partnership, Lancashire Hospital, Well and West Birmingham NHS Trust took part in this strike. Furthermore, the Guardian Daily General Practitioner, GP, said developing cancers and enduring cannot climb stairs 7.2 million strong waiting list for NHS scans and treatment. Professor Camilla Hawthorne, the chair of the said the record delays for patients finally be seen was leaving people feeling and forgotten. People with heart problems, those a hip or knee replacement, signs of cancer, whom GP said need to be seen urgently. In an interview with The Guardian, concerned that some of these patients saw their health rate as a delay in accessing hospital care. She said, being sicker while they are in GPC and worry about the risk to the patient is so much greater. It's in that some people stutter because that's the nature. Hawthorne, who represents Britain's fifters, called on the NHS set up an Amazon-style patients monitor when he's seen. In an aerial world, have a system that where they are on the waiting list. We buy something online. We are told our order being ready for dispatch and the date and time. It's something along patients understand where they are. Help GPs as well. A tracker system for patients who are anxious about when they will find them to negotiate NHS. In addition, it would mean they would no longer need to ask them to ring the when their appointment will thus freeing up slots.
From our imams, the ninth imam is the first, whose imamate began at a very young age, about 8 or 9.
As-salamu alayka ya Abu Jafar, Muhammad ibn Ali, al-Barakat.
Peace be upon you, O Abu Jafar, Muhammad, the son of Ali, the righteous, the pious.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I'm your host Mehdi, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam. Imam Muhammad ibn Ali al-Jawad alayhi salam was the ninth divinely appointed imam from among the household of the Messenger of Allah. And Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam was also the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, the Messenger of Allah. Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam lived under the wing of his father, the eighth divinely appointed imam, Imam Ali ibn Musa al-Ridha alayhi salam, for a relatively short period that was not more than 7 years. However, at this young and tender age, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam displayed intelligence and talents that truly astonished the minds of great thinkers. And like his father, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam had been impressed with the greatest of virtues and the highest of morals, the most profound of knowledge and wisdom, and his eternal values became as torches of guidance and awakening in the whole of the Islamic society.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So, dear listeners, we are talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Jawad, alayhi salam, the ninth divinely appointed Imam. We find in some of the conversations of Imam al-Jawad, alayhi salam, that he speaks about ethical and moral virtues and values. Now, of course, in the religion of Islam, ethics and morality, righteousness is one of the main pillars, if not the main pillar of the religion. The Holy Quran also has many verses which speak about these ethical and moral virtues and the divine aspect of these ethical and moral virtues. In one such conversation, we find that Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam was speaking with one of his companions, and as they were speaking about witnessing things or being absent and who is considered to be responsible in certain situations and conditions, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam says to his companion that one who witnesses something and denies it is like one who is absent from that action or deed. And on the other hand, one who is absent from something but accepts it is like the one who witnesses it. So here I think it's a little bit important to kind of explain this a little bit further. Now it's mentioned in prophetic traditions that to everyone is that which they intend. So based upon this idea, of what an individual's intention is. So if someone witnesses something but they deny it, or they denying here most probably means not being complacent with that action, not being in agreement with that action, and of course not being satisfied or content with that action that you witnessed, then you will be free from the sin of that action that was being committed, and you will be considered to be absent from it. So this was the first part of the tradition that we find in this conversation, which was that he who witnesses something but does not accept it, does not agree to it, denies it, is like one who is absent from it, right? So, for example, if we see oppression that is happening, or something, somebody is doing something bad, and we make it known that we are not in agreement with what is being done, and that we are not complacent or satisfied or happy or in agreement to this oppression that is happening, or this bad thing that is happening in front of us, and we deny this act, we reject this act, we condemn this act, which in reality is alluding to Nahi Anil Munkar, which is the prohibition of evil, then it is like you are absent from that action. But the next part is also of concern, and that is that if someone is absent from something but accept it, its good or evil will be, recorded for that individual. Now, you might be thinking, well, how is that possible? Again, as Imam al-Jawad said in the conversation, that one who is absent from something but accept it is like the one who witnesses it, and therefore they are responsible for it because they have witnessed it. So, for example, you're not present where the physical oppression is taking place. So across many of the Muslim lands, for example, Palestine or Syria or Iraq or Yemen, we see that, or we don't, you know, directly see, but we know that oppression is taking place. And so physically we are absent in this situation. But we are, you know, we accept it. We're okay with it. We're not in opposition to it. You know, we are satisfied, content, no problem. Or even, you know, if we are complacent or we are, you know, we don't have a position, we are, you know, I guess neutral is not a correct word, but we are disassociated from this, you know, whatever is happening. In that kind of a situation, Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam says, it is like you are actually witnessing it. Because you're accepting it, because you're complacent with that situation, because you have not opposed that evil status quo. And if you witness it, then of course you are responsible for that situation. So, you know, dear brothers and sisters, you know, don't be complacent in these kind of situations. When you see something bad happening, then you should condemn it because it is bad. Of course, according to the, you know, rules that the true jurisprudential experts have put forth for us. And on the other hand, if you see something good, go ahead and promote it and go ahead and spread it and make it more prevalent in society. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Jawad, alayhi salam.
And now we invite you to listen to Shaykh Winay Keita about Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam.
Imam al-Jawad salawatullahi wa salamuhu alayhi is an interesting case study for many, many different subjects. Ibn Shahrashub in his Manaqib tells us, these are very important ulama of the earliest period, who narrate the ahadith of A'imma. Kana shadid al-udma fashakka fihi al-murtabun. He says that because of the dark complexion of the boy, فَشَكَّ فِيَ الْمُرْتَابُونَ, the hypocrites, المرتابون are people who turn away from the religion. So they started using this as shock. So color became their excuse for doubting in the imamate of Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam. So just so you know, I'm not, this is Ibn Shahrashub narrating in the traditions in his Manaqib. So it gets worse, unfortunately. So then, now these may not have been his uncles. This may have just been the outer circle or the, you know, the people around the imam. So then they ordered a group of people to come to Mecca during Hajj to examine the body of the father and the son. This is known as physiognomy, ilmul firasa. Where they come and they look at this body, they look at these facial features, and they didn't have DNA testing in those days, right? So they would come and see, okay, you know, I think he's descendant of this person. No, he's not, doesn't belong to this. Of course, from Sharia perspective, this is not a dalil, of course. But they brought the imam and his son in the presence of Ma'mun during Hajj. Imam al-Jawad was 25 months old, according to the ahadith. 25 months old at the time. And they come to the imam, and they examine him. And look what happens now. فَلَمَّا نَظَرُوا إِلَيْهِ خَرُّوا لِوُجُوهِهِمْ سُجُدًا. And when they saw him, these examiners fell onto their face in sajda. They fell into sajda and they said, يَا وَيْهَكُمْ أَمِثْلَ هَذَا الْكَوْكِبَ الدُّرِّ وَالنُّورَ ظَاهِرٌ. Woe upon you, meaning the people that called them here to Mecca. Is there something akin to this glittering star and the blazing light? Ma huwa illa min dhurriyyati an-nabi wa amir al-mu'minin. That he cannot be anything but from the progeny of the Prophet and Amir al-Mu'minin. Wa huwa fi dhalika al-waqt ibn 25 shahra. And at that time he was 25 months of age.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.ir/en Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many other great programs as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
A diverse range of programs, spirituality, youth, Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. The U.S. Defense Department, the Pentagon, on Friday, 5th of May, signed a long-awaited policy to supposedly make it easier for service members to access mental health care. The policy implements the Brandon Act, signed into law by President Joe Biden in 2021. As the military continues to grapple with mental health issues and suicide within its ranks. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Website Axios has covered this story and tells us more. The Pentagon has started to implement a law that requires the provision of mental health services for help-seeking U.S. troops amid a soaring number of suicide cases among active duty soldiers. The Brandon Act, passed into law as part of the 2022 National Defense Authorization Act, requires the U.S. military to provide a mental health evaluation if a service member self-reports a problem or seeks help. The law, signed by Undersecretary of Defense for Personnel and Readiness, Gilbert Cisneros, also allows service members and active duty soldiers to seek confidential help outside the chain of command in an attempt to reduce the stigma around mental health. The legislation languished for more than a year after its passage in 2022, with the Pentagon claiming that it was working on how best to put into effect the requirements of the act. Democratic Representative Seth Moulton, who sponsored the act, said in a statement, "Shame on the Pentagon bureaucrats who took 15 months, during which even more service members died by suicide, to make this happen." The U.S. Department of Defense, the Pentagon, still has a lot of work to do to curb the shockingly high number of suicides among our young men and women who serve in the military. But this is a big step in the right direction. The law was named after Brandon Caserta, a 21-year-old sailor who took his own life at U.S. Naval Air Station Norfolk in June of 2018. Brandon Caserta told his parents and friends in several letters that he was constantly hazed and bullied in the US Navy. Terry Caserta, Brandon's mother, who leads an advocacy group fighting to end suicide deaths among active duty troops and veterans, said his son had told his commanders that he was suffering from depression, but they took no action. Democratic Senator Tim Kaine said, "For over a year, I've been working with Brandon Caserta's family to push the Department of Defense to implement the Brandon Act, which will help service members access the mental health support that they need." Adding, "The Casertas lost their son under unimaginably horrific circumstances and have turned their grief into an effort to help other service members. I'm glad that the Department of Defense is finally implementing this important bill to prevent future tragedies." Official reports said 519 U.S. service members died by suicide in 2021, the latest year for which numbers are available. The figure showed a slight decrease from the previous year's 582 suicides, but the trend over the last decade and more has been increasing. Lester Martinez-Lopez, the Assistant Secretary of Defense for Health Affairs, said in a statement on Friday, 5th of May, "Once implemented, service members will be able to request a mental health evaluation for any basis by initiating a referral through a commanding officer or through a supervisor. The new process will require the commander or supervisor to refer the service member to mental health provider and protect the confidentiality of the service member to the maximum extent practicable in accordance with applicable laws and Department of Defense policies." Public Broadcasting Service, PBS.org, has also covered this story and tells us more. Recently, U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin claimed that he has ordered the creation of an independent committee to review the military's mental health and suicide prevention programs. According to the Defense Department data, suicides among active duty soldiers increased by more than 40% between 2015 and 2020. The numbers jumped by 15% in 2020 alone. In long-time suicide hotspot postings such as Alaska, service members and their families contend with extreme isolation and a harsh climate. The suicide rate has doubled. A 2021 study by the Cost of War Project concluded that since 9/11 attacks, four times as many service members and veterans have died by suicide as have perished in combat. The study details stress factors particularly to military life, high exposure to trauma, mental, physical, moral, and sexual stress and burnout, the influence of the military's hegemonic masculine culture, continued access to guns, and the difficulty of reintegrating into civilian life. The Pentagon did not respond to repeated requests for comment, but Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin has publicly acknowledged that the Pentagon's current mental health offerings, including a Defense Suicide Prevention Office established in 2011, have proven insufficient. Last year, the U.S. Army issued fresh guidelines to its commanders on how to handle mental health issues in the ranks, complete with briefings, slides, and a script. But daunting long-term challenges remain. Many soldiers fear the stigma of admitting to mental health issues within the internal military culture of self-sufficiency, and those who seek help often find that stigma is not only real, but compounded by bureaucratic obstacles. Much like the issue of food insecurity in military families, a network of military-adjacent charitable organizations in Alaska has tried to fill the gaps with a variety of programs and outreach efforts. The situation in Alaska is particularly dire. The stresses of an Alaska posting are compounded by a shortage of underground therapists. During a visit to Joint Base Elmendorf Richardson in Alaska earlier this year, Army Secretary Christine Wormuth heard from base healthcare workers who say They are understaffed, burned out, and can't see patients on a timely basis. If a soldier seeks help, they often have to wait weeks for an appointment. The website USO.org has also covered this story and tells us more. Suicide rates among active duty military members are currently at an all-time high since record-keeping began after 9/11 attacks and have been increasing over the past 5 years at an alarmingly steady pace. In fact, some branches of the US Armed Forces are experiencing the highest rate of suicide since before the Second World War. In 2021, research found that 30,177 active duty personnel and veterans who served in the U.S. military after the 9/11 have died by suicide, compared to the 7,057 service members killed in combat in those same 20 years. That is, military suicide rates are four times higher than deaths that occurred during military operations. For military families and parents, this trend is extremely troubling. Several causes can lead a person to commit suicide, but for active duty soldiers, there is an additional layer of potential stressors on top of the regular ups and downs of life that puts them at risk. In light of this heartbreaking trend, the USO Warrior and Family Center has developed special programming in line with the Center for Disease Control strategies to prevent suicide to support service members in need even in the darkest of times. Service members who are stationed in other countries or deployed to combat zones often experience loneliness and isolation. They must spend months, sometimes years, away from their families and friends in unfamiliar locations while dealing with the stress and dangers of their daily duties. In fact, according to the Blue Star Families 2021 Military Family Lifestyle Survey, 8 in 10 active duty responders have been separated from their families in the past 18 months due to military service, and 31% have been separated for a total of 6 or more months. It can also be difficult to bond and spend time with fellow service members, depending on the location and resources of their assignment. This is a serious issue for the morale and mental health of our nation's military, which not only impacts operational readiness, but also the personal lives of those who are in U.S. military uniform.
This is A to Z. An introduction to an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, what is the practical treatment to save us from meanness? In the name of God, the most gracious, the most merciful, may his peace and blessings be upon Muhammad and his pure, immaculate Ahlul Bayt. Salaamu Alaikum, dear brothers and sisters, you are listening to A to Z in Islamic Lifestyle, IRIB English Radio, Color Islam page. I'm Farhad, your host, and I'm very honored to have you with me for this session. So, we are going to start our program with a very important question, and that is, I say that I suffer from the complex of meanness. What is a practical treatment to save me from it and from its bad effects? So to answer this question, we need to know that firstly, you should recognize the cause so that the treatment can be easy. Here, we're going to offer the main causes of this complex first. Number one is either you are imagining it or others are making you imagining it. Either we imagine that we are meaningless or other people around us are making us imagine it this way. This is one of the causes. And also, repeated failures in life and not achieving an aim that was once in our dream makes us feel meaningless. So, it's very important to recognize the cause of such a feeling. And then, when we recognize the reason, when we recognize the cause, the treatment can be very easy because the cause is clear to us. So, in the next part, we are going to mention the solution for this kind of feelings. Welcome back, dear brothers and sisters. You're listening to A to Z, IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page, and Farhad, your host. And we are going to continue our program talking about the solutions and the practical treatment to save us from feeling meaningless. In the previous part, we talked about the causes of feeling meaningless, and that was either we imagine that we are meaningless or others are making us imagining this way. And secondly, repeated failures in life and not achieving an aim that was once in our dream makes us feel this way. But for the cure, we can suggest the following principles. We are going to mention them. First, try to achieve success in your life to strengthen your moral, and then you can aim for another success and a bigger step. Secondly, read some books regarding this topic in order to achieve some success by reading religious books or every other books that regards to this topic. We learn how to struggle with such feelings, and it's really, really helpful. And number three, we need to seize any opportunity to prove our personality in a lawful way. I do not mean that you seize others' opportunities or show off by doing good. Number four, if you want to mention, we need to persuade ourselves that we are a successful person by assistance of Allah. So believing in Allah, it's a very, very important element that we, by the help of that, we can get rid of from this feelings. And number five, do not forget that make your intentions sincere and just for the sake of Allah when doing good deeds, because this is the moral secret of everlasting success and progress. So if we try to make our intention just for the sake of Allah, we will never get worried about what others think about us. And in this way, it's a secret, it's a golden secret. We have it in our religion through Quran and Hadiths. We understand that this way of thinking, this way of living, and if we establish our life based on this very important principle, we never feel meaningless, inshallah. So I hope everyone a happy life. Thank you for staying with us.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
In the limelight.
after collapse of two major U.S. banks and record capital outflows from smaller lending banks. America's banking industry, which was worried about a banking crisis, is now worried about economic growth. Economic experts say that the recent pressures in the banking sector and the possibility of destroying their credit in the next stage will bring America closer to recession. We have taken a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. Cable news network CNN has covered the story and tells us more. According to notes from the Federal Reserve's March policy meeting released, the fallout from the recent banking crisis is likely to push the U.S. economy into a mild recession later on this year. Since November of 2022, economists at the Federal Reserve have predicted subdued growth and a weakening economy during policy decision meetings. In March, they said the banking crisis heightened the forecast for recession. Minutes from the U.S. Federal Reserve's most recent two-day monetary policy meeting on 21st and 22nd of March noted, taking into account the potential economic effects of the recent banking sector developments, U.S. Federal Reserve economists' projection at the time of the March meeting included a mild recession starting later on this year. This is the first time in the current hiking cycle that staff economists have forecast such a recession. Nancy Davis, founder of the Quadratic Capital Management, in a note recently said, "The main takeaway from Wednesday's 12th of April Federal Reserve minutes is that the central bank anticipates a mild recession in late 2023 and that the soft landing window seems to be closing quickly." According to the minutes, policymakers at the U.S. Federal Reserve voted unanimously recently for a smaller interest rate increase after turbulence in the banking industry set off fears of bank runs. The notes released on Wednesday afternoon, 12th of April, highlighted the uncertainty behind the decision, which came just days after the failure of the Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank. U.S. Federal Reserve officials raised the benchmark lending rate by a quarter of a percentage point, the ninth rate hike in a row. CNBC has also covered this story and tells us more. According to the minutes from the U.S. Federal Reserve's most recent two-day monetary policy meeting, some participants noted that given persistently high inflation and the strength of the recent economic data, they would have considered a half a percentage point increase in the target range to have been appropriate at this meeting in the absence of the recent developments in the banking sector. Given those projections and their own economic uncertainty, policymakers judged it prudent to increase the target range by a smaller increment at this meeting. Policymakers also claimed that actions taken by the U.S. Federal Reserve and other government agencies to mitigate possible contagion and secure the U.S. financial system had quelled immediate fears and calmed conditions in the banking sector. Because of that, they said, they thought it was appropriate to address strong economic data and sticky inflation rates by raising interest rates by a quarter of a percentage point instead of pausing altogether. Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell said at a news conference following the conclusion of the March policymaking meeting, "While bank failures can erode confidence in the banking industry, they can make borrowing harder, which can also curb spending and ease some pressure on prices and the labor market." Claiming that the banking industry remained sound, Jerome Powell said, "Such a tightening in financial conditions would work in the same direction as rate tightening." Silicon Valley Bank's collapse was the second largest bank failure in U.S. history and underpins the worst banking crisis since the Great Recession. The bank, which had over $200 billion in total assets at the end of last year, primarily provided banking services to venture-backed technology companies. The turbulence in the technology industry meant many customers were burning through cash and taking out their money at a faster pace. Signature Bank was the other casualty of the U.S. banking industry's recent turmoil, and later, Swiss banking giant Credit Suisse, which was forced to merge with its longtime rival, UBS, as a remedy. The Reuters news agency has also covered this story and tells us more. Deposits at three United States financial institutions fell in the first quarter as the industry's biggest crisis in more than 10 years prompted a flight of funds, with customers seeking better returns elsewhere. Deposits at custodian bank State Street Corp and regional bank M&T Bank Corp fell by 3% each, while those at Charles Schwab Corporation shrank by 11% from the prior quarter. State Street stock plunged by 11%, dragging down its peers Northern Trust Corp and Bank of New York Mellon Corp. Shares of brokerages and financial advisory firm Schwab were up 2.8% in afternoon trading, and M&T Bank shares were up 7%. The results mark a mixed start to a busy week during which a number of U.S. regional lenders are expected to report earnings and the impact of the crumbling of the two banks in the country recently. Investors will also be passing executive commentary for details on the economic impact of the Federal Reserve's quantitative tightening, which has boosted the income earned via lending, but has at the same time given rise to uncertainty. Both Schwab and M&T Bank rode a surge in interest income to beat profit expectations, but State Street fell short after an outflow of client funds hurt its fees. Credit Suisse analyst Susan Katzke wrote in a research note that the State Street's earnings fell short of estimates due to lower-than-expected net interest income. Susan Katzke wrote, "The firm showed heavier outflows from non-interest-bearing accounts." U.S. Federal Reserve data released on Friday, 14th of April, showed deposits at all commercial banks in the country rose to $17.43 trillion in the week ending 5th of April, an increase that was generally evenly shared between the largest 25 banks as well as the small and mid-sized banks. That left deposits at the largest banks above the levels before the collapse of the Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank. Deposits at small banks were still short of their previous levels. Schwab, which was caught up in the recent crisis, paused stock buybacks but moved to allay concerns about its financial strength. Its chief executive officer, Walter Bettinger, addressed commentary about portfolios of debt securities held by banks, including Schwab, which are disclosed as unrealized losses in their earnings. Fitch Senior Director Bain Rumor said Schwab's net revenue may be modestly pressured throughout 2023 as higher cost funding sources weigh on net interest income, but the firm's size and scale should support profit margins at levels consistent with historical levels. IRIB English Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to IRIB English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel. Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Ideal University Student brings change in thinking and reality of the society and world. The following is part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution in a meeting with university students and representatives of student associations in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya on April 18, 2023. I don't know whether you read the biographies of the martyrs. I read them and shed tears. And I benefit from them. I truly benefit from them. I think that one of the things you should do is to read the biographies of these dear martyrs, especially some of them who were very spiritual. They made use of it. I believe you should make use of the month of Ramadan. Now, there are only 2 or 3 days left, but, God willing, you have many years ahead of you in the future. Prepare yourselves for the next month of Ramadan from now on. I have made this recommendation on numerous occasions, and fortunately I saw that a couple of our friends who spoke here today repeated this, which I fully approve of, and that is that the student community and the student associations need a solid underlying thought. This is something they definitely need. This has always been my recommendation, and I would like to emphasize this again. If the knowledge base of a young person, especially a young student, is solid, he will be assured, his steps will be steady, and he will remain persistent in his movement. There will no longer be any fatigue.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Assurance in one's heart causes one's faith to increase, and faith itself brings assurance. Assurance and composure in one's heart increases a person's faith. It is he, the Holy Quran says, it is he who sent down composure into the hearts of the faithful that they might grow in their faith. Surah 48, verse 4. They were already believers, but when the Almighty God gives them this calmness in their heart because of their reliance on spiritual and divine realities, this faith increases. So, what are these foundations in understanding? In Islam, there are personal, heartfelt, social, political, and international foundations in understanding. These all exist in Islam. The subject of freedom is one of the foundations in understanding that has been spoken about in Islam. The subject of justice is one of the most important issues in understanding. These matters need to be solved. Our young university students should think about these things. They need to work on them until they attain depth.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Gave me hope, oh Allah,
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Foreign ministers of Iran, Russia, Syria and Turkey agreed to prepare a roadmap for developing relations between Damascus and Ankara. Relations between Ankara and Damascus soured after the foreign-backed militancy broke out in Syria in 2011, when flows of Syrian refugees flooded Turkey. The safe and dignified return of Syrian refugees was one of the key principles for the Moscow talks.
It has been a key principle for all the countries present here to contribute to a safe and voluntary return of refugees and internally displaced persons to the places of the permanent residence in Syria, as well as to ensure their right to receive support. It appears important to start discussing the issue of restoring disrupted transport and logistics ties between neighboring countries and resuming trade and economic cooperation without any barriers.
The participants also discussed the U.S. measures in creating a so-called Free Syrian Army, which used ISIS militants and other terrorist organizations against Syria's legitimate authorities with the aim of destabilizing the situation in the country. Russian and Syrian militaries have recently discussed the issue, agreeing on a model of joint action in that regard. The sides also discussed the legitimate unilateral sanctions applied by the U.S. and its Western allies, which block the provision of international humanitarian assistance to Syria, including through the U.N. The head of the Russian Foreign Ministry drew attention to the fact that the U.N. humanitarian plan for the current year for Syria was funded by 8%, but the emergency appeal of the same U.N. to provide assistance in the territories not controlled by Damascus was immediately paid almost in full.
The talks in Moscow can be called historic. Iran and Russia paved the way for the negotiation process in Syria and made great efforts to ensure that this meeting took place. Moscow has demonstrated that its conditions are realistic. It was supported by Iran in this, which has done a lot to save the sovereignty of Syria. The meeting of the Syrian minister and his Turkish counterpart gives hope for the establishment of calm in the country. Turkey had to come to terms with the fact that Bashar al-Assad's power will remain. We have witnessed a reset in relations and what the collective West has been trying to prevent in every possible way.
The process of normalizing relations between Ankara and Damascus was launched on December 28, 2022 in Moscow, when first consultations were held between the heads of the defense ministries of Russia, Syria and Turkey. Earlier, President Erdogan invited President Putin to hold a trilateral meeting with the participation of the Syrian leader. This summit, according to him, should have been preceded by negotiations at the level of representatives of the special services, defense and foreign ministers.
The foreign ministers of Iran, Russia, Turkey and Syria warned that their countries will not allow any external interference in regional affairs. They expressed readiness to boost their fight against terrorism, saying they will be in full swing to ensure security. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
EU leaders are accused of failing the people of Sudan. The 27-nation bloc's weak foreign policy in Africa has allowed tensions to develop into chaos and carnage, according to some legislators in the European Parliament.
We must understand that hoping for the best is not sufficient. If we do not engage constructively and in a timely, effective manner, we will always need to run for cover when it is already too late.
It's the Rapid Support Forces versus the Sudanese Armed Forces. Rival generals, once allies, are battling it out.
The West were happy to legitimize a de facto military dictatorship because this is the arrangement that has served our financial interests and the interests of the IMF and the World Bank for many years.
In the Sudanese capital, Khartoum, hundreds of people have been killed and thousands injured. The situation in Darfur and other regions is also dire. When it comes to African nations, the West is accused by critics of only ever having been interested in pillaging natural resources, such as gold, diamonds, and oil. At least 450,000 people have been forced to flee their homes in Sudan since war broke out on April 15th.
Let us not allow for a new tragedy, or at least do the utmost of our efforts. If the EU wants to live up to its values, this is the time to go for our limits.
Foreign powers are competing for influence in Sudan because of its position on the map. Apparently, the EU has taken its eye off the ball.
Don't make the mistake to only focus on the war in Ukraine. All kinds of leaders seize the opportunity because they see the European Union as a soft power entity.
The EU has opened its doors to millions of Ukrainian refugees. The bloc is being criticized for not providing safe routes for those escaping Sudan.
I hope that this will be a matter for the meeting of the Foreign Affairs Council, which takes place this weekend. It's currently not on the agenda. I would urge the Commission to try to address this.
Some commentators claim Washington is pouncing on the crisis with an aim of implementing ideological changes by removing Islam from Sudan's constitution. Once again, the US is accused of interference to try and further its own agenda. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The ex-Pakistani Prime Minister was detained on Tuesday afternoon while leaving the Islamabad High Court premises in a stunning turn of events. Khan was arrested by a team of the country's anti-corruption body that was assisted by a large contingent of paramilitary troops when he was making his attendance in two cases related to sedition and attempted murder. Khan's graft case is one of over 100 cases registered against him since he was ousted from power in a parliamentary vote in April last year. The former PM has been accusing the government as well as the top military officials of involvement in assassination plot against him, which was denied by both. Just hours before his arrest, Khan said in his last video message that he will prefer to die rather than accept slavery.
I might have been arrested in a false case when this message reaches all of you. The fundamental rights and democracy have been vanished from the country. Whatever happening at the moment is because of this imported government. So it's time for all of you to take to the streets for real freedom of the country.
The government says that Khan's arrest was made in accordance with the law, as he was involved in corruption of 119 million British pounds.
Mr. Khan was doing corruption along with his family and friends when he was the Prime Minister. The embezzled money was deposited in a trust which was registered under Imran Khan and his wife.